Can you tell us what sort of progress you meant when you were referring to trade talks with China?
Well, I think we're doing very well. China's paying us tremendous tariffs. We're getting billions and billions of dollars of money pouring into the treasury of the United States, which in history we've never gotten from China, as you know. It's been very unfair. I had a fantastic meeting with President Xi, who I both like and respect. One of the things that came out of that meeting was fentanyl.
Hello, and welcome to the Reason Podcast. I'm Catherine Mangyward, filling in for Matt Welsh, and I am joined today by Peter Suderman, Eric Boehm, and Nick Gillespie. Say hi, everybody.
Happy Monday.
Hi, everybody.
Hello.
It's Happy Tuesday.
It's a special
Tuesday
edition of the Monday podcast, and we are here to talk about tariffs. In particular, we're here to talk about tariffs with Eric Boehm, who has been covering this issue for a long time. Oh, my God, Eric, what's going on? It's so unfair that China has not been putting money in the U.S. Treasury until now.
It is. It's so unfair, as the president said in that clip that we just played, incredibly unfair that China has never put money in the U.S. Treasury voluntarily. And actually, they're not putting money in the U.S. Treasury now. So, I mean, I guess that's why he's still frustrated about this.
Was there a silent hashtag on that, actually?
Yeah, actually, yeah, spell it out. Yeah, I mean, he keeps putting these tariffs on China and keeps expecting, I guess, that China is going to change their behavior because they're paying these billions of dollars. And it's true, there are billions of dollars coming into the U.S. Treasury. About $18 billion have been collected on the various tariffs that Trump has imposed since June of last year, first starting with the steel and aluminum levies, which he lifted just recently on Canada and Mexico. So three cheers for that one. But now the trade war has really, you know, ramped up between the U.S. and China, a series of tariffs that were imposed over the latter half of last year. And now the president, after the breakdown in negotiations just the middle of this past month, decided that the tariffs were going to be increased on about $200 billion worth of Chinese goods from 10% to 25%. Again, we have to say it. China's not paying those costs when goods from China come into the United States. Importers pay that tax. They're not allowed to literally take the goods off the boat until they pay that tax that goes directly to the Treasury, and then that cost just gets passed along to users and buyers and consumers.
So on Monday, the president warned that the tariffs may still rise, quote, very substantially, and said further, quote, we are not ready to make a deal. We're taking in tens of billions of tariffs, as he said in the past. We just heard. He has also, though, alternately said, we are on the verge of making a deal. China typically seems to be saying, we don't know what's going on. Like, I actually was reading a bunch of stuff this weekend, and the quotes in like the South China Morning Post and others in other sources, China keeps saying, we would love to sort this out in a mutually beneficial way. We can't figure out what the U.S. wants from us. Peter, this kind of uncertainty is a huge problem, not just for China, but for the U.S. Why?
Well, it's a problem for the U.S. because it means that the trade war is going to persist and that Trump is going to keep doing the sorts of things that he's been doing in terms of tariffs. And that's going to keep hurting U.S. consumers. And in general, it means that even if there's a deal a month from now or 6 weeks from now or 2 weeks from now, it means that people can't plan. And when you can't plan, that makes medium and long term decisions about where you're going to make products and what products you're going to bring in quite difficult. These things don't just get done overnight. I mean, long haul shipping from China takes weeks or months in some cases for products to get here. Those decisions have to be made well in advance. Factories have to be tooled up in China if that's where you're going to make goods. And so we're actually seeing we're seeing some analysts and executives even start to talk about moving their supply chains out of China at great expense. Expense that will, like tariffs, be passed along to American consumers just in order to avoid this because they don't know what's going to happen. And even if things basically work out fine, even if the trade war is completely over in October and no one ever talks about this again, people are like, you know what? Donald Trump solved that trade problem. Boy, he fixed international trade. America is great again. Even if that happens, because there's no sort of clear progression here, there's no ability for companies that have to make these decisions to plan, it's really detrimental to the economy and to businesses that want to start up with new products or bring products into the country.
I think look at what happened with the steel and aluminum tariffs, for example, right? These went on not just on China, but on all steel and aluminum imports into the U.S. last year. And the idea was, the theory here from Trump and his supporters was, this is going to bring steel and aluminum manufacturing jobs back to the United States. It's going to give companies a reason to invest in factories here. And it did a little bit. Aluminum manufacturing jobs ticked up by about 300 total over the about 12 months that the tariffs were in place. Meanwhile, we paid billions of dollars in costs. So you basically paid tens of millions of dollars per job created. It's a terrible way to create jobs if you want to do that.
And they're now using the tariffs to raise money to pay off people who have been hurt by this.
There's that
right?
weird loop with the farmers too, where you're raising money to pay off. But I think the point I wanted to make is that then just out of nowhere last week, Trump decided he was going to lift the tariffs, or 2 weeks ago rather, he was going to lift the tariffs on Canada and Mexico, the metals coming in from Canada and Mexico, which is a huge amount of the ones that were subject to that tariff. And it happened just like that. So to your point about uncertainty, Peter, is that businesses don't really know, and people that I've talked to for a feature that I'm currently writing about all of these consequences of the trade war have said there's no way to know, you know, how long these tariffs are going to be in place. Why would you invest in building, you know, spending the amount of capital investiture that you would have to build a new factory here in the United States for whatever it might be that you're currently importing from China, when midway through that process, the tariffs could just disappear, in which case now you've wasted all that
and
money.
And in a lot of cases, they're not going to move to a new factory in the United States. They're going to move to a factory in Korea or something like that.
Nick,
or India.
So I have
that question about certainty and uncertainty is something that we've actually been hitting going back to the Bush years in the early part of the 21st century, because Bush injected a huge amount of uncertainty. First off, you know, global politics injected a huge amount of uncertainty into everything, including the economy. Bush's own policies, and particularly his willingness to spend, and the Republicans, and later the Democrats as well, just to spend and spend and spend without any kind of idea that they were ever going to balance the budget or reduce the debt to GDP ratio or anything like that. Obama pushed that through again. I mean, that was one of the biggest problems with Obamacare through the long a period of time that it took to be implemented, and it's already being repealed, et cetera. But, you know, if you have an economy that is just suffused with uncertainty, there's no ability to kind of do even midterm planning, and that freezes up a lot of activity. And I think we're seeing that consistently. And it was a little bit different under Bush. It was a little bit different under Obama, and it's different under Trump. But that consistently that consistent level of total uncertainty, just not a good thing.
But Nick, isn't it true that China is cheating when it comes to trade? I mean, this is something that
obviously,
I think, you know,
yeah.
Of course, people on this podcast and many of our listeners are broadly in favor of free trade and find these tariffs to be counterproductive mm-hmm. and unhelpful. At the same time, many people also have a deep sense of what is fair, and China is not playing fair. True or false?
Yeah. No, I mean, on a certain level, the first thing I was going to say is that, you know, China is also the largest owner of U.S. government debt. They own about $1.2 trillion in treasury bonds. So they're actually helping us out a lot to some degree, by buying more and more of our debt, although they've slowed down since the trade war started, which is another issue that's worth kind of effect that's worth thinking about. There is a sense, and I think people, you know, it makes a certain amount of sense. If the Chinese government is massively subsidizing certain exports, if it's doing all sorts of things, either with its currency or with its own trade policies and stuff like that, people get rankled by that. But what I think needs to be understood, and this is, you know, an ongoing question, which I think will be filtered into many of the other topics we talk about today, is that, you know, when you look at policies in the aggregate, it is always better for a country to be open unilaterally to free trade, because it benefits more people and it brings in within our country, and it ultimately gives us more resilience to deal with ongoing shifts, which are constant in the economy and things like that. But one of the hopes, and you know, we're not going to get there through this process for sure, would be that China, which is facing all sorts of internal problems, because nobody believes, even within China, nobody believes the numbers that they're putting out, much less in the larger global economy. They need to come to a kind of reckoning day where they actually start to be at least approaching the transparency that is expected from places, like in Europe and other parts of the world. I happen to have a couple of friends who have manufacturing they manufacture devices and whatnot. And many of them years ago moved out of China, partly because it was very difficult to do business and know what you were getting when you were paying for your stuff to be made there. And it turned out when you factor in things like returns or stuff not being up to spec, it was actually cheaper to do it in a place that, on, you know, at first glance would seem much more expensive.
There are definitely issues with the way China engages in international trade. There are tech issues, there are intellectual property issues. There are the ones that Nick was just mentioning as well. One of the big errors, I think, that the Trump administration made, besides failing to understand the basic economics of how tariffs work, is thinking that they could go into this one-on-one and actively sort of engaging in this trade war as a one-on-one policy. Of course, you go back to the 2016 campaign, and Trump, a lot of his success in the primary was because he ran against the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, mm-hmm. that was originally designed really as a way to control China, to put constraints on what China was doing by bringing together a dozen countries that do significant trade with China around the Pacific Ocean. And this was meant to be sort of a multilateral way to get China to behave better on the international stage. Trump, again, misunderstanding what that deal was, claimed several times that it was a giveaway to China, that it was going to help China. And the voters rewarded him for that sort of skepticism. But I think now people who are paying much more attention to sort of the background negotiations of what's going on in the trade war and not just the on the surface politicking that we're getting from Trump and his top advisors, they say that really that's what needs to be done. Is that it needs to be the United States, it needs to be South Korea, Japan, Canada, all these other countries collectively putting pressure on China. And that's something that the Trump administration so far has not really made much of an attempt to do.
One of the appeals of Trump, and you're obviously right, and I know that we've talked about this in the past, where it was Rand Paul who kind of pointed out to Trump what he was going off about the TPP at one point. It was clear from the way he was talking, Trump thought China was part of the TPP as opposed to the target of the TPP. But, you know, that assertion that he can control, you know, these large foreign forces, and, you know, whether it's Chinese, whether it's trade flows, whether it's flows of immigrants, you know, whether it's flows of terrorists, you know, that is part of his appeal. And it's kind of fascinating then to ask the question, is it that people know he's bullshitting, but they want to believe, or they actually think he can deliver on it? Because one of the things that is, you know, complicates all of this stuff is that the economy, at least so far, has been doing better under Trump than it had been doing in a long time. So that it may be, and when you look at what most economists predict about the effect of the trade war, et cetera, it's negative, but it's not that great. It's kind of like in the way that NAFTA for the United States was a net positive, but not a very big one. And so that larger economic issues, including, you know, almost a decade of pent up demand or subnormal demand coming back to life, it might be that he's able to, you know, wage a trade war and still have economic growth in a way that helps him be seen as if he's actually taming monsters that he's not.
I mean, in many ways, this was an own goal for the Trump administration. And I think people, you know, sort of will frequently over attribute the president's ability to impact or influence the economy. But by at least one calculation, the per household cost of the increased price, the increased cost per household imposed by the tariffs is actually greater than the per household amount of money that people got back from the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, the Republican tax bill that was passed in 2017. And so, you know, even if the impact isn't huge, in a lot of ways, Trump is undoing some of the positive economic impact that his policies have had.
There's also another layer on top of that, which we alluded to earlier, which is Trump's idea that now that we have this free money from China, we can spend it on things. And in this case, this week, we are spending it on subsidizing all of the farmers who have been desperately negatively impacted by trade restrictions. Eric, do we have lots of free money from China we can give to farmers to make them whole for their losses?
No, again, we don't have any free money from China. There is no money from China flowing into the U.S. Treasury. There is money that people are paying to import goods from China. There is sort of an added cost now on importing goods from China, but that's paid for by American importers. It's paid for by American businesses. It's paid for ultimately by American consumers like you and I.
But Eric, the money from China.
The money from China, sure. And even if it was coming from China at this point, we've basically spent almost all of the tariff revenue. We've spent more than 70% of the tariff revenue on this supposedly temporary, there's no such thing as a temporary government program, right? This temporary program.
Especially not a farm subsidy.
Certainly not farm subsidies. They go on forever. We're actually using a New Deal era, Depression era program that had been just drained of resources, but continued to carry on in sort of a zombified state within the federal government. Trump has resurrected that as the conduit through which the Treasury will feed money to farmers that have supposedly been impacted or have seriously been impacted by the cost of the trade war. Farmers get hit by this on both ends because they're buying farm equipment, which is made from steel and aluminum. So they're paying higher costs for that. And then the reciprocal tariffs that China has put on American agricultural goods especially has really, really cut off foreign demand. We export, for example, soybeans. About 45% of American soybean crop gets exported, and the vast majority of that goes to China. All of a sudden, that market goes away. The prices have dropped. Farmers are down, in some cases, tens to hundreds of thousands of dollars on their crop from last year. This program is going to bail them out in the short term. But what farmers say is that, you know, fine, you know, maybe filling or, you know, refilling the coffers for what they didn't sell. Basically, the government is buying the soybeans that they would prefer to just sell to China. That's fine and good for this year. But in the long term, losing those supply chains to China is going to be a serious problem because China is now buying more soybeans from Argentina and from Brazil and elsewhere in the world. And even if the trade war, as Peter said earlier, even if it were to go away in 6 weeks and it's all over and we all forget about it, those Chinese importers that now have those connections and those supply chains set up in other parts of the world are probably going to continue to buy from those other parts of the world. And that means the U.S. export market probably declines in the long run, even if the tariffs were removed tomorrow.
There's also an asymmetry here. You can buy commodities like soybeans. You can quickly change who you're buying those from. And of course, you do have to plant them and grow them. So it's not a perfect market, the market doesn't clear immediately, but that is quite a different thing than building or retooling factories, which takes time. And as you have said earlier, if you interrupt that mid-flow, you can lose all of the investment there. Let's shift a little bit to our favorite guy in Congress, Justin Amash, who we talked about him on the pod last week, but he has continued to kick up a storm. The Michigan Republican, I guess Republican at least for now, has been tweeting about not just the Mueller report, but also, you know, in the last week, made a couple of other forays onto Twitter to make his displeasure with the president's conduct known. Peter, is Justin Amash going to hoist himself on his own petard here, or is he doing the Lord's work, or both?
Possibly both. Justin Amash is, I think, probably, possibly, maybe. Matt Welch should be here to weigh in on the exact probability here. But like, Justin Amash seems to be gearing up for a run for president. And I think that part of what he is doing is getting attention, differentiating himself from President Trump. And so what he's doing, I think, is in some ways, it is the Lord's work, as you say, or as you suggest, in that Amash is saying what other Republicans won't, or what other Republicans won't say publicly. He is saying that Trump has engaged in impeachable acts. Note that that is not directly a call for impeachment. It is simply a description of the things that Trump has done. I think it is an accurate one. And he is saying that the way Trump has handled himself in the aftermath of the Mueller report is wrong and unpresidential. And in this media environment, that's the way you get attention, especially if you're a Republican. If you want to is by criticizing the president in a way that is very direct, that a lot of Republicans won't do, and by differentiating yourself from the guy at the top of the ticket.
And yet there's been, I think, a sort of meta discussion for those who have been sticking around to hear it about whether this is in fact just attention seeking by Amash or whether there's something else going on. I mean,
it's not just attention seeking.
For instance,
can we
gone on every single cable news program every single day last week, and he didn't do that. Instead, he like was charmingly photographed explaining himself to some school children.
And he's holding a town hall.
He's holding a town hall in Grand Rapids, which is his home district.
And this is, I mean, let's give him the benefit of the doubt, or rather, to in a kind of Ben Franklin way, there's nothing wrong with seeking publicity and doing good at the same time. I mean, this is a kind of version of visible industry where Amash is principled enough to where he didn't miss a vote for thousands of votes in a time, and then actually reportedly cried when he realized he had missed a vote by accident.
I think I was later didn't cry. I think I wrote up about. Okay. I think wrote up the crying, and he was like upset, but didn't really cry.
Tears forming.
But I mean, but he takes this stuff seriously. He takes this stuff seriously.
Yeah, I mean, to be clear, when I said that he was that I thought he was trying to get attention and differentiate himself, that wasn't a criticism. I think, though, that like it's part of a strategy to define himself apart from President Trump and to lay out a line of criticism against President Trump.
It's worth pointing out, though, you know, beyond that, and, you know, none of this contradicts what you're saying, but it kind of extends it in a slightly different direction, which is that it's really good for the country to have a position which is not simply based on partisanship, because most of the Democrats who are going after Trump are going after him because he's a Republican and because he's Donald Trump and they hate his guts. Most of the Republicans, or all of them, with the exception of Amash, are silent. And we all know, because they talked about this under Obama or under Clinton or whoever, that when, you know, a Democratic president or somebody they despise politically or ideologically did stuff similar to what Trump did, you know, they talked about impeachment, and they talked about how he's contravening the Constitution and taking away powers that belong to Congress, all of this kind of stuff. And I think it's really helpful to have somebody like Amash who, again, you know, I hope he runs for the LP Libertarian Party presidential nomination, or for the Republican one for that matter, and puts out a different possibility, because this is, you know, it's going to be a year or so still before the next season of Man in the High Castle drops, but as long and Rick and Morty as well. But we,
if we
believe in alternative lines,
I'm very excited.
If we believe in alternative time, like if you can imagine an alternative timeline, you can travel there and take some of it and bring it back home and alter your own timeline. That's Amash is essentially.
I feel like we were cruising along in some normal political punditry, all of a sudden it was like, now we're in an alternative.
You guys saw the Dan Harmon tweet in which he posted, he had like a table full of post-it notes for season 5 of Rick and Morty ideas. And I feel like we just stumbled into one of those post-it notes.
It's as exciting as the paper that Trump was carrying that had a bunch of notes on it.
The best one just said, Wenwolf. Do not congratulate.
I think that, you know, one of the interesting questions for somebody like Amash, and I realize I beat this drum every chance that I get, but it's that
we should have a conversation about Amash's
from a reason perspective. You know, Amash is probably as good as we've ever seen in somebody who's a member of the national government, you know, a congressman, a senator, a president, anything like that, maybe even a Supreme Court justice. And he's great because, like, all of his policies are consistent with most of what virtually all of what we believe. I mean, there's a couple of issues, and he's anti-abortion in a way that complicates things and all of that. But he lays out his rationale, and even when you don't agree with him, you can respect his process and how he comes up with stuff. And I think the larger question for him and the larger question for the libertarian movement moving forward and thinking about, we don't want, you know, the Democrats to win just to screw over Trump, and we don't want Trump to win just to kind of stick our thumbs in the eyes of Pete Buttigieg and Kamala Harris or whoever. Like, we want an alternative world that is fully kind of fleshed out, or is at least sketched out and suggested, that we can then start to inhabit. And I think Amash has yet to do that. I think that's the thing that he needs to do if he's going to have a major impact beyond this local question of Trump in 2020 and whether he runs or whatever. I think it's that question of, is he going to bring a broad vision, which some of the Democratic candidates have. I think people like Bernie Sanders, for instance, talks about an America that is predicated upon his policies, and he suggests things. I think Obama did that in 2008 in a way that's, that's really necessary to changing from being a political candidate or something into being a full-blown social movement that actually takes the country in a particular direction.
I think the other piece of this, though, is just the human one, which is the question of whether someone who is a libertarian in the way ish-ish that we are libertarians can exist inside the current two-party system at all.
Yeah.
And, you know, my read on it, which, you know, is not any particular privileged information, but just that, you know, there have been a series of points where there's been a question for Republicans and indeed even Republicans who identify as libertarian-ish or free market who have had to say, am I going to go with my pre-existing principles or the principles as I perceive them of the people who sent me here to represent them? Or am I going to go with party loyalty and in particular loyalty to Trump? And lots of people, the entire Freedom Caucus have chosen, House Freedom Caucus have chosen loyalty to Trump. And Amash hasn't, which I think is laudable, but it also basically makes it untenable for him to continue to exist inside the system.
I think maybe the best metaphor for this entire thing is the House Freedom Caucus voting to like condemn him or criticize him or whatever it was that they officially decided to do. I mean, this is the group of libertarian-ish Republicans within the House Republican Caucus that Amash literally helped to found. He is a co-founder of that group, and he's now more or less been not officially kicked out of it, but he stopped going to the meetings. The group is basically now just almost indistinguishable from the most Trumpian of Republicans. Mark Meadows, who used to kind of be Congressman Mark Meadows from North Carolina, who used to kind of be in our camp to some extent and on many issues, is now a loud defender of the Trump administration and is spouting the talking points about the end of the Mueller investigation being a total finding of no guilt there on the part of the president. He's totally exonerated. And so that's what's been most disappointing in this whole thing to me, has just been that once Amish said some of the things that he said on Twitter over the last 2 weeks, I thought there may be some other Republicans who are willing to now come forward since they would not be alone in doing it. And that just the complete silence there has really been really disheartening.
It's like he stood up and on the top of the hill and was like, join me. And behind
literally
them,
literally
like,
no
just
one
like
came
a tumbleweed.
Although there were a few that did, push back against Trump's declaration of a national emergency related to the.
That's true. I mean, it's not to say that there are literally no libertarian principles lurking anywhere in the Republican Party or even in the Democratic Party.
No, but
of course,
I think they're very weak. And, you know, one of the things that I hope, you know, and this I know we're going to be talking about the EU elections in a bit. And I think hopefully what this is the beginning of, though, is, you know, Catherine, when you say, is there place for, you know, libertarian ideas in either of the major parties? And I think the answer is really no, in a way. But what the good news is that those parties are really fraying, because the Democratic Party is going through a major redefinition in this election cycle. And I think even if Joe Biden, who's kind of considered centrist, wins the nomination, it's still going to proceed apace on some level. And the Republican Party does not, you know, I mean, they've gone through a major restructuring. I mean, you know, this is not a party. They use a different rhetoric than they did even 4 or 5 years ago. And I think that's, you know, a long, you know, documented decline in party affiliation by regular people. And it's like, again, you know, this is why if Amash can, or people like him, can shift from talking about specific policies that make sense and are logical, but to what is that larger worldview that is, made possible by that? That's when we actually will see a significant change in either of these parties or a new party
Do you think? Do you think Amash has to run for president to make that sort of pitch? Because it seems
no, not necessarily. Yeah, but I think it's easier to do as president. Nobody would be and who knows if we'll even be talking about him in another week or two. But you know, nobody would be taking Pete Buttigieg seriously if he weren't running.
Yeah,
for
that's
president.
Exactly.
If he was even running for congressman or senator or governor of Indiana, people would be like,
that is exactly the point.
South Bend has vision for America.
Yeah, I think that's exactly the right
Politico headline.
I saw Buttigieg speak last week, and I was thinking, here's a guy who is he's very competent. He's obviously got a good handle on the issues, but he's so young. He's mayor of South Bend. He seems like he should run for Senate. He should run for governor. It seems like there should be a few steps there of, you know, okay, in a decade, think about running for president. And nowadays, we just immediately, everybody wants to run for president because that's the only way you get your message out, it seems like, if you have this sort of vision. And I think that's something that's broken, really. In our politics.
The counterexample, though, right, Peter, is Bernie Sanders, who has spent an entire life sort of toiling
several lifetimes,
it feels, toiling in, you know, not obscurity, not at all obscurity, but not, you know, not the kind of presidential limelight, building up a reputation for consistency and sort of just shoving the boulder up the hill every day on his own worldview, on his own vision. And I guess my question is, like, is there an alternate history, since we're doing alternate histories or alternate timelines, where, you know, like the Bernie Sanders story seems like a redemption story right now, or like a success story, right? He worked hard all his life and he put this vision forward and eventually people saw the truth and embraced it. And now he has changed the party, right? Like, that's a story you could tell about Bernie Sanders. It seems highly contingent. It seems just as likely that Bernie Sanders could have been essentially Ron Paul and, you know, pushed this consistent view his whole life and had it amount to nothing. And in fact, he may still be Ron Paul, right? It may be that in 5 years, what looked like the socialist moment goes the way of the libertarian moment. Is there any way to sort of do this worldview building thing, to like build a big picture, to be the Justin Amash that Nick wants Justin Amash to be, and guarantee success, or even get close to approximating that?
Guarantee success, no. But make it more likely, for sure. And what made Bernie Sanders, what makes Bernie Sanders a success is that he was there and he was ready. And that's the difference. When
he was like, put me in, coach.
Well, he was, I mean, he has been at this for decades, right? And because he has been at this for decades, because he has been reasonably consistent, because he has honed his abilities as a communicator, and not just as a communicator, but he has thought, I don't want to say always deeply, but certainly a lot. He has really thought a lot about his ideas and why he believes certain things. And so he's had a lot of time to kind of workshop responses to common criticisms, to figure out what the best way to handle certain types of questions is.
There have been white papers.
There have been white papers. That's
not
true.
By him exactly. But
Bernie Sanders is less a creature of white papers than, say, someone like Elizabeth Warren. Bernie Sanders is...
Warren is literally a creature of white papers.
She's just like, a collection of white papers.
If you like removed the enchantment from her, origami. Like it would just, yes. Like all the white papers would flutter to the ground.
I would like to read some of those and write articles based on them. But Bernie Sanders is not that. Bernie Sanders is really a kind of a politician in the activist mold. And so he comes out of organization, not exactly in the same way that President Obama did, but sort of an outsider kind of fringe activism. And he has brought that to the center of Democratic politics, again, just because he was there and he was ready when the party was ready. And there's this is the difference between him and someone else who maybe tried a similar strategy, is that sometimes you play the long game and the party is the party or the organization or the people are never ready. And so they never come to you and you have like just this little small following and that's it. And
sometimes
that's all you ever
just
have.
Stand outside the double Dutch ropes and the opening never comes.
And the double Dutch rope is that a...
Yeah,
jump rope.
Never mind, Peter. It's a jump rope.
I'm giving you a jump rope metaphor.
I have never jumped rope.
That's sad. You're missing out.
I would like to see Bernie Sanders try to jump rope.
I think I would pay like straight up, honest, real price, $2,500 to see Bernie Sanders jump rope.
Wait, is this the two where two people do it at the same time?
Yeah, and two ropes.
Okay, so we want to see Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren jump rope together.
No.
And I hate to say it, but doesn't that kind of rope jumping have an ethnic name to it?
Double Dutch is an ethnic name, I guess.
Is that a slur?
There's double Dutch and also Chinese jump rope.
I think that's what the olds called it. In my more enlightened youth, we called it double Dutch.
No, it's merely the Dutch. I understand.
Yeah. So
it's probably Belgian now.
So, but the other person, the counterexample for a way of being politically successful in 2019 is Nancy Pelosi, who is the un-Sanders.
She's just a bulldog.
She's just, she just only does politics. She doesn't do ideology at all, as far as I can see. And right now, she and Donald Trump are feuding. Yay! And in particular, they are feuding over, well, they're feuding over a lot of things. Is infrastructure week? No, it's not infrastructure week. No, it is infrastructure week.
It's always infrastructure
week. It's always
week.
Infrastructure week.
And it's never infrastructure
week. We're in like a quantum infrastructure
week. We're in a quantum infrastructure
week. Always both is and isn't infrastructure week.
You can know where infrastructure week is and also how fast it's moving, but not both at the same time. So Donald Trump called off infrastructure week last week in a fit of pique and then tweeted what turned out to be a doctored video of Nancy Pelosi stammering, Eric, we can't trust our eyes anymore. Nothing on the internet is real, right?
Yeah, obviously. I mean, yes. But the problem is a lot of people out there, and I'm going to pin this largely, I think, on the olds, unfortunately, the people who literally grew up telling my generation, don't believe the things you read on the internet, don't talk to strangers on the internet, don't do all these things because the internet is a scary, dark place full of lies and mischief.
Are now like, if the president tweeted it, it's true?
If the president tweeted it, it must be true. China's paying for the tariffs and Nancy Pelosi can't finish a sentence without stammering over her words, right? And this is, I don't think a large subsection of people believe this. This is the equivalent of the millennials can't afford a house because they spend thousands of dollars every month on avocado toast, right? It's one of those graphics. Obviously, that's true. There are individuals who believe these things, and just like social media and Facebook and Twitter has amplified that. And I think this is just going to be part of our politics now. This is not going away. In fact, if anything, these sorts of fakes and tricks and edits are only going to get more deceptive and more believable as time goes forward. So. I don't know what the answer is here, but that's just something we have to deal with.
Nick, what happens?
The answer is better. The answer can only be and should only be better media literacy on the part of readers and consumers of news. Also,
okay.
One would hope the creators and producers of news as well. No, but seriously, because Kara Swisher, a big tech journalist who now writes for the New York Times, had a piece over the weekend in the New York Times talking about how, like, you know, Facebook wouldn't take down this video, and thereby they are betting, its false message, et cetera. And like, it needs to be regulated. It needs to be broken up. Josh Hawley, the conservative Republican from Missouri, a senator, wants Facebook dead, not just regulated, not just broken up, but he wants it to go away. That's, you know, this all feeds into that narrative that we need to regulate and control or get rid of certain types of social media if it allows for expression that we don't like. I think that's a terrible thing because, Catherine, as you were getting at, it's, you know, we can't believe anything that we read right off the bat. We always have to verify as much as anything else. But if we want to maintain free expression, because so many of the things that we argue about actually are not cut and dried, the best thing we can do to preserve expression is really focus and force, you know, a kind of a culture of free speech where we admit that we're never going to know with certainty. And, you know, the platforms and the news agencies that do the best job of kind of giving you content that doesn't turn out to be full of shit or is merely designed to confirm all of your biases will get more reputational status and hence do better in the marketplace, either of ideas or of commerce. I think that's it. That's the answer. And, you know, this has always been a question in the United States. We were one of the first countries to have a non-regulated press where you didn't have to register with the government before you could start printing stuff. And that goes back to a famous court case in the colonial period tried under British law. We should do everything we can to maintain that.
And yet, here's the headline in the Washington Post about this story. Trump's allies insist he is winning in feud with Pelosi, period. Her backers say she showed up the president, period. What do we do about these bubbles, Peter? Yeah.
Bubbles?
Bubbles.
Between
media
are,
bubbles.
Are they,
no.
Are
people
they
are in there.
At each other?
We have epistemic closure.
Epistemological bubbles. Ideological bubbles.
That there is an ideological
echo
bubble.
Echo chambers.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Bubble filters.
Well, I think the main thing that we need.
I like it, though, that the place you went was like, are Trump and Pelosi like in some sort of bubble war?
I think that have seen one of those fake news gifs about that. I think I'm just very excited for the 2030s when President Ocasio-Cortez appoints a reality czar to determine what is and isn't true on the internet.
And the realities are we'll go to war with the meme lord.
Yeah. And then we're going to have a federal department of memes and we're going to have to regulate and determine which memes are acceptable and true and which memes aren't. And I think we're going to have to rework the Constitution just a little bit to make this happen because there's probably.
Those are the most terrifying words in the English language. We're going to have to rework the Constitution just a little
probably
bit.
Probably some issues with the First Amendment once we get there. But that's the trajectory we're on, and I think we can all see it. And, you know, it's going to be great because finally the government's going to step in and tell us which things are true and which things aren't. And that's what the government is good at, right?
Yeah, well, so this of course raises
uniquely competent
the question, as always, of who is the decider, and our general view that, like, I don't know, Facebook probably ? But also not Facebook is our equilibrium right now. That does not seem
well. So this is Facebook's argument in public is at this point that basically the government should give them a protected status and then outsource that business to them.
And they should work with
Congress and with the regulators to write the rules that they have to then abide by. Those rules, the primary purpose of which will be to make sure that no other competitors can exist and that Facebook exists forever, and that all of the money that flows into Facebook keeps going
to
Facebook
rather than
anywhere else.
The secondary purpose, that's absolutely the primary purpose. The secondary purpose is to give Facebook cover so they don't get in. They don't have to deal with the public relations problems of, oh, you allowed this video to stay up. They can say, oh, well, it's the Department of Memes that said it could stay up. Like, I mean, it's
Facebook,
not us.
This literally is in some ways what Facebook, it's not literally. It is an exaggerated, but has an element of truth.
It is
hyperbolically what Facebook is asking to be is the Department of Memes.
And yet I am tempted to go with what I think of in this case as the Jesse Walker line and to say, actually, we have been in a state of ongoing low grade panic about our inability to know what is and isn't real for at least a century, maybe a few centuries, and that each time a new technology emerges, everyone loses their shiz for a hot minute while they realize that you can still kind of tell what's fake and what's not if you look closely and if you pay attention to the context. And in the meantime, typically, we have mostly in the United States avoided passing harmful legislation that restricts speech overmuch in the throes of the panic. We should try to do that again because probably we will muddle through and be fine.
I mean, that is one thing about this particular episode is that the Pelosi video was very, very obviously faked. It just looked like a slowed down video. If you've ever seen slow motion in like a movie or a television
like
show,
a sports,
you don't need to have had a lot of experience playing with settings in Adobe Premiere to know that that's what was going on here. This was a slow
and yet,
motion.
I don't know. Remember the Jim Acosta microphone battle of 2018?
Think of the Zapruder film. I mean, the Zapruder film or the footage of the Ruby Ridge, you know, the first point of contact between the feds and the Branch Davidians. I mean, like, our world has been, I mean, Catherine, as you were saying, you know, it's at least 100 years old. It's 1,000 years old. It's 10,000 years old. We're always contesting what is going on. And one of the things I think we need to understand is that it's not because there's more of this shit out there per se that we're talking about it more. It's actually because we're contesting politics so much more. We look at all sorts of things and we are grabbing on anything that we think will justify or rationalize our pre-existing bias. We should understand that this isn't a technological question. This is actually a political question. And when we get to a point where where there's more of a consensus, all of these problems or many of them will disappear or reduce in severity to a point where we won't be talking about it anymore.
I want to loop back to my What You Consume In from a week or two ago, which was a novel called The Power, about when a thought experiment about what would happen if women were able to overpower men, in this case through electrostatic energy in their fingertips. I just want to come back and say that I finished the book and it turns out women are humans also and therefore super awful. And the way that story ends is with women like raping and pillaging and committing basically nuclear war. But the framing of the story is it's set 5,000 years after the great disaster, which is meant to be set in our near future. And all of the historic artifacts about a time when men were more powerful than women have been wiped out. And there is a male historian like trying to piece together this story. And there's like all these lady historians condescending to him and being like, we get why you might be interested in that idea, but let's just be clear, the evidence isn't there. So we've got, I guess this is all just by way of saying, after the great cataclysm of memes that is coming, we won't ever actually even be able to reconstruct what history was like before when we knew what was real.
This has always been a problem. I mean, you rely on sources that you kind of don't understand
the cultural context of at best, or really the veracity of it all, and what sort of agendas were involved in history. I mean, this is, you know, I like to think of, like, imagine if future historians had to reconstruct the aughts entirely from, say, Andrew Sullivan's blog. Right.
I choose not to imagine that.
On the one hand, Andrew Sullivan's a good journalist and and is somebody who is there, who's like he provided a huge amount of information. Right. I mean, sort of towards the end of his heavy blogging days, it was something like 50 posts a day. Right. But he had a huge not him personally, but like he was posting like 50 times a day. It was really pretty impressive. He covered a huge range of topics, in particular the federal government and foreign policy, but also social issues and all sorts of things, presidential race, all that sort of stuff. But Andrew Sullivan also had an awful lot of very personal and idiosyncratic biases. He would tell you this himself, and you would have it an incredibly weird and skewed view of history if that's the only thing you had. And so this is
what
this
if Andrew Sullivan was our Herodotus, is what you're asking.
Yeah, basically. And what if Herodotus was Andrew Sullivan?
He was probably right.
I think everybody understands right. that he was in some, you know, he may not have been as interested in Sarah Palin's gynecological records, but other than that, they're pretty much
I want to talk very briefly before we get to our what are you consuming. The European Union had some elections this weekend, and some surprises happened there. In particular, if you look at the different headlines, you know, the thing that has attracted a lot of attention is, okay, you know, once again, you know, we have a kind of surge of right-wing populism that appears to be ascendant. You know, there is cause for alarm on that front. At the same time, the kind of populist and nationalist parties are not cohering. They seem to be at war with themselves. The fact that Brexit continues to be pure shenanigans complicates the story. Is the EU our future, Nick?
That's a very interesting question. I mean, the one thing that I think is worth taking away from the EU elections, and there's all sorts of provisos, because, you know, the EU as a legislative body has been losing kind of power in a kind of felt way, if not a technically legal way. But the idea is that it's clear that it's not working anymore. It's not exactly clear that nationalist parties have triumphed. So, for instance, I mean, a lot of people were making a big stink about Marine Le Pen and her party doing better than Emmanuel Macron's party. But her party actually did worse than it did in the previous election. The Brexit Party in England is fascinating because it didn't even exist, you know, 15 minutes ago, and it's now the single largest British party representing. And what's more important is that when you look at the Tories and Labour, they're falling apart. I think that's the real message. There's also, by the way, a Liberal Party, a classical Liberal Party that did well. And that's going to be very important in the EU Parliament going forward in whatever kind of coalition government is formed. But I think the main takeaway from it is that the EU, as it was conceived, was not the beginning of a new era of anything in Europe, but actually it was probably the last gasp, and not necessarily a bad one, of a post-war consensus of a different type of Europe, which in many ways was much more libertarian than it would have been otherwise. But like the United States, it's, you know, the center is not holding that well, because what these parties were, you know, and these policies were designed to deal with is no longer what people care about. And I think we're seeing that in the U.S. As well. And, you know, that's why I will let Matt say in absentia something about the Declaration of Independence and the rise of unaffiliated or independent voters. But, you know, that this is where we are. And it's a global phenomenon.
A book about this.
I not only wrote it, I read most of it as well. So I feel like I'm kind of an expert on what's in that book. But no, but I mean, this is, we are waiting for the next kind of large consensus that's similar to what America had in the post-war era to come back, you know, to present and to reveal itself, both in America and in Europe and in South America as well. Because what people are dealing with in places like Brazil, it's not the breakdown in the authoritarianism of kind of left-wing tyrants and right-wing tyrants, you know, circa 1970. It's not Pinochet versus Allende or something like that, but it is something different. And we're we don't know what that's going to look like yet.
I think it's a mistake maybe to overstate the degree to which the populist or nationalist parties really did well in Europe. I mean, look at what the Green Party did in the election over the weekend. They finished second in Germany, third in France. They got more votes than the Tories did in England. That's not a populist party. I mean, it's a single issue party, but it's certainly not something that we would lump in with the populists. What you're seeing here is really more of a diffusion of votes across a broader spectrum. It's not controlled by two parties. And I think a lot of that is institutional too, right? That the United States' system, it's not just that we have this sort of creaky two-party system that's been around for 200 years for cultural reasons or social reasons. It's because of like the political institutions that sort of maintain that. It's very difficult to start a new party. You couldn't start a Brexit party in the United States. Not that you would, because we're not Britain, but I mean, you couldn't start the equivalent
who
of that
we be
weeks before an election.
Brexiting from?
Yeah, it literally wouldn't exist. You would need to raise so much money. You would need to have spent so much time in courts.
California
just to get on
the ballot. Was going,
that's true.
Wasn't California
going to be a Calexit party, right?
And Texas is always one boot out the door.
And then subdivide. But yeah, you're right, Eric. And, you know, the way that it reveals itself here is in people just stop saying, you know, they can't go elsewhere. So they just stop being.
Justin Amash would never have been a Republican in the European Parliament. He would have been in a different party to begin with, or whatever the equivalent of the Republican Party is there. The other thing I think it's notable from the European elections, turnout over 50% for the first time ever there. And it's the first time that the turnout had declined in every election for the European Parliament since the first one. And this year it shot way up. So I think that says something interesting about and I have no, you know, real good sources on European politics here, but I think it says something interesting about the degree to which Europeans are now looking at the European project perhaps differently in the wake of Brexit, in the wake of the United States distancing itself from Europe. I think there maybe you'd have to, you know, look at more of the data and the exit polling and whatever. But that's interesting to me that I think maybe people there are starting to take that project more seriously. And I think that's probably a good thing because, you know, in the end, for all the problems it has, the European Union has been a boon to Europe economically and to the world economically, even if it, you know, foists a lot of stupid regulations upon the people and businesses that exist there.
That was good. You just held down the Matt Walsh line in his absence. So I'm sure he thanks you for that.
Well, although it is, I mean, I think, you know, the easy read on it, and not necessarily the wrong one, is that a lot of these countries are upset by refugees and, you know, kind of the problem of Islam, not as a terrorist threat per se, but as a kind of cultural threat. I think it's probably safer to say that it's also largely a question of economic growth, and that the EU, which I think is pretty spectacular in terms, I mean, it's like unbelievable, really, that, you know, 60, 70 years ago, Europe was at war with itself for the second time in 20 years. And now they have basically free travel and guaranteed citizenship all around the European continent, which is bigger than it was conceived of in 1945. Like, more countries are considered European than were back then. That's kind of a good thing. And I think in many ways that's liberal or libertarian. But they didn't deliver economic growth in a sustained and robust way for all of the parts for a lot of reasons. And one is that they didn't actually force Greek, the pig countries, to actually do austerity or to get their governments to a size that they could actually pay for and things like that. But Eric, I actually think that part of the problem is there's a lot of good in it, but I think the EU did not deliver the economic growth that would have allowed people to kind of want to still be in it. They're like, screw it. Well, you know, we're not getting enough out of it.
Well, there is a distinction between economic freedom and economic growth.
Yeah,
right?
I think. Right. That's basically it.
They maximized economic freedom in many ways in unprecedented in Europe, at least. But it's true. Like, everyone didn't wind up with gold paved streets and money in
their
pockets.
The trade union, undeniable benefit for pretty much everyone involved. The fiscal union, well, I mean, take it or leave it, depending on where you are. It's been a loss
once again
for Germany.
The question is whether
they can't pay for what they want. I mean, that's why, you know, Macron, who is a centrist kind of, even though he had been in Hollande's socialist government. But, like, you know, the yellow vests are pissed because they're already not making that much money, and then they have to pay extra gas tax on top of this and that and whatever. And, like, they have an unsustainable welfare state, and they were not able to grow their way to a place where people felt like they were getting a decent enough deal.
I think this is the story of the 21st century, whether or not markets can get bigger and gooder faster than government gets bigger and better.
And just to bring it back to the United States here, there was a great piece. A lot of these like New York Times safaris to Trump land have turned out not so great, but there was a really good one in the Times this weekend looking at Lordstown, Ohio, and talking to voters there at the auto plant that had shut down. And I'm bringing this back around to the European elections, I promise. Yeah. One of the quotes in the piece was from a guy named Jeremy Ladd who worked there, and he's now taking classes at like a nursing school. He's changing careers. He's doing the right thing instead of hoping and praying that like the factories come back, which they're not going to do. But he describes a lot of his like the people who live in the town with him as free radicals, that they vote one way one election, they vote another way another election. They're not necessarily committed to Trump. They feel kind of betrayed by the fact that the jobs haven't magically come back since Trump was elected. And I think that's that description of a lot of voters being free radicals right now really stuck with me. Is just that's sort of, to your point, the state of the 21st century, or the second decade of the 21st century, is there's a lot of people, whether they're the yellow vests in France or whether they're the blue collar workers mm-hmm. in Indiana and Ohio, that are unhappy despite a level of prosperity that few humans in history have achieved. And they're just bouncing around looking for more.
I want to commend you for still reading those Trump safari pieces, which I gave up on long ago, and also use that to segue into our final section of the Monday, but actually Tuesday pod, which is what are you consuming? Eric, other than Trump safari pieces,
all the Trump safari pieces,
what are you consuming?
I've been really digging on Chernobyl, the HBO miniseries. I have not seen the most recent episode because I was away this weekend, but the first three are all fantastic, and it's very dark, as obviously a nuclear meltdown is occurring sort of in the background really of the narrative, because the main narrative involves the nuclear scientist who is there investigating why the explosion happened in the first place, and he is sort of saddled with a Soviet apparatchik who is, you know, keeping an eye on him and making sure he doesn't say anything he's not supposed to publicly. And kind of the interplay between the two of them, of the scientist who is played by, I forget his name, who is on Fringe years ago, but then it's Alex Sarsgaard, Peter Sarsgaard, no. We're just going to have to cut this whole bit.
Stefan
Sarsgaard. That's him.
Wait, are there more? Is there more than one of them?
There are so more many Sarsgaards than there are Baldwins.
No.
It's like a nightmare.
We'll just cut all that on the back end.
It's all staying in.
The relationship between the two of them, and particularly the Soviet official, his sort of slow realization that it's not the nuclear plant that's the big problem here, but rather it's sort of the rot that is inherent to the Soviet political and social system that has caused a lot of these problems. It is really brilliantly well done.
I want to see a rumble between the Sarsgaards and the Hemsworths.
I actually was just sitting here trying to figure out if the Sarsgaards were the Hemsworths. I was like, wait, is that one of them Thor? I couldn't remember. Related to Eric's nuclear viewing, we also have a great Reason TV documentary out this week about whether nuclear power might be the only way forward in terms of minimizing the impacts of climate change. So
power good, socialism bad.
Yes, that's our takeaway. Always.
Unfortunately, they're inextricably linked even in the United States.
True. Nick, what are you consuming?
I read, the past week, I read Mary McCarthy's 1963 novel, The Group, which is about a group of women who graduate from Vassar College in 1933. When it came out in 1963, it was a bestseller. It was on the New York Times bestseller list for 2 years and was later made into a movie with Candace Bergen. But it's a really fascinating, it's a great old fashion kind of novel in that it takes a long kind of deep cut at society in a lot of different ways, kind of a cross section of society of different classes, even though most of the people are from the upper crust and all of that. And it is really worth, it's a well done novel, interesting set of characters and stories that play out over about a 5-year period. But it's also amazing to think about just in terms of gender relations and a bunch of other social conventions. It's really captivating. So I highly recommend it.
Speaking of lady-oriented media, even though we're not 100% sure that there are too terribly many ladies who listen to this podcast, if you are out there, I recommend that you watch, after reading Nick's book, that you watch Fleabag, which is the second season of which it was just released on Amazon Prime this last couple of weeks. Both seasons are great. They are short, you know, 6 episodes each. It's a dark comedy about having a sister and other sort of domestic topics. And it's particularly great because of the star who is unnamed. We don't ever have a name for the protagonist. She breaks the fourth wall and sort of looks at the viewer and chats with the viewer and just generally adds like a really delightful layer of commentary and artistry. Also, the second season has a really hot priest. So just saying, for your delectation.
Catherine, do you you have a sister? If you both watch it, do you assume the other one of you is the sister?
No, you know what? I actually was talking with my sister about this, and I have a beef with Hollywood, which is that super responsible older sisters don't run away to Hollywood to become screenwriters. And so the responsible older sister character in every drama, in every comedy, is like lame and underdeveloped. And I truly believe that responsible older sisters are not lame for obvious reasons. But yeah, like this is it.
You're
this
personally
is,
invested in
I'm
this
I'm very invested in this theory. This actually,
so
Fleabag,
you're
going to
be doing Fleabag fanfic.
Yes. Actually, what I was going to say is this show is good because the older sister initially looks like a caricature in this mold of older sisters written by younger sisters who ran away to become screenwriters, but actually kind of turns into a well-rounded character who's quite interesting. So that's my plea to Hollywood or maybe to responsible older sisters to run away and become screenwriters.
The creator of that Fleabag, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, also played a robot in Solo, the Star Wars movie. She was basically the only good part of Solo.
She's pretty bomb, and I look forward to more from her. Peter, wrap us up. What are you consuming?
Speaking of science fiction, I have been reading the new Ted Chiang short story collection, Exhalation. Ted Chiang is the author of Stories of Your Life and Other Stories, which was the collection that came out a bunch of years ago that included the short story that the movie Arrival was based on. The movie is great. I think it's one of the better, probably one of the better sort of bigger budget, it's kind of a medium budget film. It's one of my favorite movies probably of the last 10 years, but the short story is even better. The short story is just a marvel. And his new collection is similarly just wonderful. And he is probably at this point the foremost practitioner of the science fiction short story who is working today. He's never written a novel, and he writes stories that are the right length. And it's really just such a pleasure to see him investigate science fictional ideas and sort of the logic and human nature problems that they present.
Let that be a lesson to all the writers out there listening. Mm. Sometimes you don't need to write a book. You just need to write an article. That's the takeaway here. Yeah. One of them. Thank you very much for listening to The Reason Podcast. I have been your host in place of Matt Welch, Catherine Mengi Ward. And I was joined today by our special guest, Eric Baim, as well as our regulars, Peter Suderman and Nick Gillespie. As always, you should go on to iTunes and rate and review us and say nice things about us while you are there, and mean things about Matt Welch while he is not here. Thank you very much.